blast had thrown one mutant back and given Laudis a chance to scramble to his feet. The apothecary took two more steps before a massive boulder, easily as large as a grown man, slammed into his skull from behind. Blood splattered Lydran. Laudis's body hit the ground, sliding a little downwards, and fetched up on a rock. Horror surged through Lydran, and then, with a cold stab, he took in the precious gene seed canisters locked to his comrade's belt. Nothing else mattered. Not pride, not honour, not vengeance for his battle brother. Those canisters were his chapter's future, and he would not abandon them to these mutant scum. Lydran swung his staff furiously and smashed the nearest brute under the chin, throwing it back. He spun his staff, then threw the weapon like a javelin. It crashed into the face of the next mutant and drove it back, long enough for Lydran to lunge forward and snatch the belt of precious capsules from Laudis's hip.
"I am sorry, brother," he gasped. "Let this be the first deed of my penance."
He awkwardly maglocked his precious cargo to his belt, snatched up his fallen staff, and locked it in turn to his back. Then he was away, pounding up the rubble, climbing one-handed up the jagged cliff face. Lydran drove upwards, snagging a handhold, then pushing up with his feet and snatching the next. The stump of his left arm hung uselessly at his side. Mutants howled and bellowed behind him, their claws digging into the rock as they pursued him. Still Lydran climbed, fury and sheer stubbornness propelling his wounded body to the very limit. With every lunge, the glow of daylight grew closer, and his heart thumped as he heard the crash of gunfire from up ahead. The hard boom of bolters firing told him that his brothers still held out. Some of them, at least. He wouldn't fail. He wouldn't fall. Not now. Lydran was almost torn from the rock face as a huge hand closed around his foot and pulled hard. He felt tendons strain and snap in his leg. His back gave a shout of pain as muscles strained against the full weight of the massive mutant that had him in its grip. Lydran's hold slipped. The lip of the pit was so close. He had to risk it. He snatched out a mental feeler, grasped the merest wisp of warp energy, and sent it surging down through the rock face. Beyond the veil, he felt metaphysical fangs snap shut, grazing his mental defences and sending white fire through his mind. Below him, he heard a crunch, and the weight abruptly vanished from his foot. He glanced down to see the mutant falling away, a foot-long spar of rock jutting from its eye socket, where Lydran's manifestation had dragged it out from the cliff face. Three more mutants were swarming up to take their fallen fellow's place, though. They were almost upon him.
"One last push," he thought, and lunged upwards, reaching for the edge.
His yellow-armoured gauntlet was suddenly clasped in one of black. Lydran felt himself hauled upwards out of the pit to slam down on its edge. He looked up with amazement and saw a black-armoured warrior towering over him in an unfamiliar mark of power armour. One shoulder pad bore the heraldry of the Space Wolves, and the Fenrisian's features were rugged, scarred and hairy. He wore a bloodthirsty smile that bared his canine fangs in the half-light. Something swept overhead, a dark shape with assault cannons chattering in its nose mount. Gunship, thought Lydran, warp shock making his thoughts slow and viscid.
Not one of ours.
He looked about and saw Imperial Fists and black-armoured Space Marines fighting shoulder to shoulder, storming through the half-collapsed entrance to the minehead, executing cultists on every side.
"Watch, Captain Lothar Redfang, Death Watch," growled the Space Wolf by way of introduction. "We heard you had an infestation."
Then he leaned out over the lip of the pit, aimed his bolt gun straight down into the faces of the mutants below, and let fly. Act 2, Chapter 9. Magus Jai stood upon a metal walkway. The fingers of one hand curled around its brushed steel railing as she looked down upon the industrious scene below. Jai felt a brooding disquiet as she watched cult neophytes hurrying to and fro across what had once been an ore storage silo. Now, it served as an arming chamber for the cult. The neophytes came in through a hatch in the chamber's south side, each bearing an amber-hued cloth, some weapon or piece of war gear that they believed the Blessed would wish to wield. These they deposited upon the broad steel benches that had been erected and decorated with worm forms and candles, transforming them into arming shrines touched by the divinity of the Star Children. The cultists then left in solemn procession, flowing out of an adjoining doorway and back around towards the weapons cache by other corridors.
"They look like insects, worker drones bringing offerings to a hive," Jai thought.
The image gave her a frisson of real horror, though she could not have placed quite why. Perhaps it was the presence of the Blessed themselves, standing silent in the chamber's centre, watching with inhuman eyes as the offerings piled up before them. Metamorphs. The Blessed of the Star Children. They who wore Father's gifts upon their flesh and stood highest in his regard, next only to his own purebred children. Feeder tendrils sprouted in twitching nests where mouths and nostrils should be, tasting the air below, glittering nests of night-black eyes. Chitinous mouthparts worked, more thick plates of chitin rasping together as the metamorphs shifted restively. Some had crustacean-like claws where their hand should have been, or bladed limbs edged with serrated bone like those of some huge and horrible insect. All were hunched and powerful in build, their adapted utility suits straining to contain their divine mutations. Jai knew that the thought was traitorous, but she couldn't stand proximity to the Blessed, not even this close. She knew that they were noble, devoted in thought and deed to the cult, utterly incorruptible, bearing the stigmata of even the most gruesome blessings without complaint. And she had seen them fight, whip fast, utterly lethal, employing the gifts they had been born to with deadly effect. Yet they smelled wrong to Jai, felt subtly wrong, despite the beatific halo she saw simmering around their bulbous heads. The feeling was made worse by the compulsion to adore and love the creatures, which grew in strength the closer to them she drew, only to sour as she discovered her discomfort growing too. Somehow the warring sensations felt to her like biting into some warm and comforting foodstuff, only to discover cold, wet rot at its heart. Jai shook off the traitorous thoughts as the catwalk creaked, heralding Lure's approach. She glanced up and saw the Primer striding towards her, tall, noble, his face that of an honest labourer touched by Father's blessings, his gimlet eyes those of a merciless and insightful general. Lore's great coat flowed behind him as he walked. His heavy miner's boots clanged against metal with every step.
"Brood sister," he said by way of greeting,
halting beside her and staring down at the preparations below.
"Brood brother, Star's blessings," she responded,
and the smile she offered him was genuine both in the warmth of its welcome and the twist of its disquiet.
"Preparations near completion," he said. "They do. You do not approve of this," he said,
a statement more than a question.
"I understand its necessity," she said carefully. "But you do not approve," he repeated.
She heard no reprimand in her brood brother's voice. He understood her mind, just as she understood his, their empathy near telepathic.
"This was to be our weapon of last resort," she said. "A day and a night they fought in the Delve Mine," he replied, voice grim. "By the battle's end, not a brother or sister of the cause remained alive. That ambush would have put paid to half the Gyrish regiments at a stroke. We did not even destroy half of one Space Marine army. Now it seems we face a second. and their strategy succeeds in Hive Angelicus, despite all our best efforts, she said, unable to keep the bitterness from her voice.
We were so close, Sharvik. Our hands were around their throats, our shackles straining fit to shatter. And then the hounds of the oppressor came.
And they crush us, drive us back at every turn, said Lur,
his heavy brows drawing down in a scowl.
Despite our every effort to show our people the truth, the populace waver. They are cowed, terrified, lost.
And without their hearts and souls, we shall not see ascension, said Jai,
something clenching in her chest at the mere thought of defeat. How did one face the idea that they might fail an entire world's worth of people?
We cannot let the torch be extinguished, brood sister, said Lur,
placing one taloned hand on her forearm, where she held on to the railing.
It must be done. The weapon must be unleashed, she said.
To her, it sounded as though she intoned some terrible death sentence. In a way, she supposed that was true.
Faithful and heretics will fall together, he said.
Our voice upon the conclave will not survive this.
She heard regret in his voice, but strength also. Resolve.
Had the ambush succeeded?
She let the sentence trail away, aware of its futility. They served the will of the Star Children. Fate raced towards them like an avalanche. There was no time for might have been.
If our voice on the conclave is not dead already, they soon will be. The weapon may prove a mercy to them.
And yet,
he said, his grip tightening for a moment and then falling away. She felt the separation in that moment, the finality of the gesture, and it threatened to break her. Something welled up within her instead. Fierce conviction that made her feel as though her heart beat in time with Father's own. Instead of sorrow, Phoenicia Jai felt pride.
Weep not for they who go early into ascension's light, for they are the blessed forerunners,
she quoted from Father's scripture.
From them all toil and pain is done, and when we too ascend to join the Star Children, there shall they await to welcome us with open arms and to show us the path of eternal freedom.
Just so, said Lor, offering her a fierce smile.
Shen will be here soon, she said,
sensing the telltale mind spore of the cult's heroic Kellamorph drawing nigh.
Then it is time to be about Father's work, said Lor briskly.
He locked eyes with Jai for a moment, and she saw her own faith and determination mirrored there in his gaze.
How will you gain entry to their fortress, brood brother?
She asked, all practicality now.
Reports suggest that the hounds of the oppressor guard every entrance, their servo skulls scouring the back alleys and tunnels.
They know only the roots of which those in power know,
said Lor, with grim satisfaction.
Amongst our number are tunnel jacks and vent scrubbers, whose labours have gone unnoticed by their so-called betters for many years.
Their own ignorance of the people they claim to rule, the people they failed, will be their undoing, said Jai.
As Father wills.
Lead them well, then, and go with his blessing, she said warmly.
I bid you this also, brood sister,
said Lor, then turned abruptly and marched away. Jai looked down again upon the blessed, now picking over the weapon offerings upon the shrine.
Like beetles on some carrion,
she thought, and again chastised herself. They were the blessed of Father, and with her brood brother to lead them and Shen to inspire them, they would deliver the killing blow to the oppressor's war machine and free the people of Gaia after thousands of years of slavery and exploitation.
That is worth any cost,
she told herself, as she watched Lur stride out to join the blessed. As Shen stalked in through the southern hatch with a rune-marked metal case clutched tight to his chest.
It justifies any means,
There is a line that we cannot cross, said Lydran, his voice still hoarse from mind dust, but no less powerful in its outrage for all that. We are servants of the Imperium, the elite of its garrison. Our duty is to protect the Emperor's realm, not tear it to pieces.
He stood in a richly carpeted antechamber within the lower levels of the conclave building, surrounded by statuary and fine furnishings. He felt like an aberration in that civilized space, his power armor still stained with gore and smirched by fire, one arm terminating in the still-settling stump of an augmetic socket. The sensation, coupled with the loss of Lourdes and so many other brave battle brothers, was not helping his mood. Nearby stood Chaplain Storn, his expression stony, and a glowering ancient Tarsan. Opposite the three Imperial fists, standing at the other side of a long Clarwood meeting table, were Watch Captain Lothar Redfang and Apothecary Osk Sorkal of the Death Watch. Xenos killers, alien hunters, drawn from the very best of every Space Marine chapter, trained and equipped to battle every alien foe that humanity had yet encountered. A space wolf and a white scar, both bearing their heraldic chapter markings proudly on one shoulder guard, both a feral contrast to the clipped and chiselled sons of Dawn. Apothecary Sorkal had steely grey hair dragged back into a horsetail from an otherwise shaved scalp. His face was leathery and scarred, his eyes watchful as a hawk's, and his moustache hanging long in the Chigorian style. Redfang was huge, of a height with Lydran, despite having yet to cross the Rubicon Primaris. His hair fell in a dark mane about a long and noble face, one eye a glowing augmetic, the other creased at its corner by laughter lines. It was a face that Lydran should have felt moved to trust, even to like. Yet there was something in the way the space wolf bared his canines in a mirthless grin, something in the intensity of his gaze, that instead left the librarian feeling unsettled.
"Your duty, perhaps," said Redfang. "Garrison sit behind their walls. Get slow, get soft. The Death Watch are hunters. There are no walls to protect us, Fist, and no lines. The war on the alien will not be won through mercy. We saw where your mercy got you by the time we arrived, did we not?"
Lydran glowered at Redfang.
"I have thanked you for your aid at Delvemine, Watch Captain Redfang, and if your ego needs the padding so desperately, then I will offer you my thanks again."
The White Scar snorted in amusement as Redfang's expression soured.
"This one has your measure quick enough, Fenris," he muttered.
"What I do not thank you for is unleashing your kill teams into the Laboratus to wreak indiscriminate havoc before we were ready to move. Nor do I appreciate your sending armed battle brothers to round up the Governor and her conclave, as though they were wayward groks, and placing them under armed arrest in their own court of judgment."
Redfang flashed Lydran a feral grin and paced over to an arched window. He leaned one forearm against the stone frame and stared out at the spires visible without.
"There is guilt amongst them, Fist," he said. "How do you think you ended up down a pit?"
Lydran fought to control his anger towards this slouching barbarian, but the Space Wolf's arrogance and presumption needled him.
"I know that much, Watch Captain."
Lydran bit out each word.
"I had intended to set matters in motion to discover the full extent of the corruption. You call yourself a hunter, but your heavy-handed methods will have sent our quarry running and closed down every avenue of investigation we might have pursued." "Do you hear yourself, Fist?"
asked Redfang, not looking around.
"Heavy-handed. Avenues of investigation. You have no idea, do you? You do not see the Kraken as its tentacles wind around you. I am the commanding Adeptus Astartes officer in this war zone," said Lydran, his words ringing like hammer on steel.
The mission to relieve Gaia was assigned to Strike Force Tor, not to the Death Watch. We have bled for this world, not you. If you wish to offer your aid, then I accept it gladly. If you have information pertinent to our mission, or to battling this foe, then share it and I will listen. But you do not simply barge in and start working contra to our strategy. You do not hold a planetary governor at gunpoint. Not even the Adeptus Astartes have the authority to do this. Red Fang barked a laugh, but there was no mirth in it. The sound was as cold and hard as a branch cracking in the grip of a killing frost.
All father take every stiff-necked imperial fist, he growled.
We don't have time for this, for your strategy. Now, are you going to stand in my way, or are you going to let me do my duty?
Still, Red Fang had not looked round, but Lydran saw hostility in the set of the big space wolf's shoulders. There was menace there, violence running hot beneath the surface, seeking an excuse to be unleashed.
That will depend on your methods, and whether you deign to work with us rather than around us, he said, refusing to be baited.
Red Fang turned at last, growling low in his throat. Sorkul raised a hand in a pacifying gesture. He looked from Red Fang to Lydran, and the librarian had a sudden thought that this was not the first time the White Scar had found himself diffusing confrontations on his watch captain's behalf.
Brother Librarian Lothar is right. We simply do not have the time. And from what we have seen of your strategy, you have no idea of the true danger here. Am I correct?
Lydran frowned, took a breath. His emotions were still turbulent from his brush with the dangers of the warp, he thought, as he realized that he too was undoubtedly being more confrontational than was necessary.
Brother Sorkul, we know that the enemy take the form of a widespread and highly seditious cult, preaching anti-imperial heresy and employing guerrilla insurgency tactics with considerable success to offset their ad hoc military structure and lack of heavy materiel.
But you do not know what they are, what lurks at the heart of all this,
asked the apothecary.
We've seen instances of mutation concurrent with the archival pick capture of Xenos bioforms, so we know there's inhuman corruption amongst their ranks, said Lydran. But if there is some deeper evil at work here, then no, Brother Sorkul. I regret to say we are ignorant of it. Ignorance, growled Red Fang, frustration evident in his tone. It kills more of the Allfather's warriors than any gun or blade. Please enlighten us, said Lydran, gesturing with his one remaining hand and the ghost of the one he had lost.
He bristled at the Fenrisian's disrespect for his chapter. Yet, after Delvemine, he could not bring himself to openly challenge it.
We are dealing with a gene-stealer cult, a parasitic Xenos infestation, said Sorkul. It probably started small, maybe just a single vanguard organism making it onto Gaia through concealment and cunning. Doesn't take long for their poison to spread, though. Once they start channeling their cursed spirits into people's minds and bodies, it spreads fast.
Lydran nodded.
If this is your revelation, it comes late, brothers, he said,
not troubling to keep the scorn from his voice.
We do not need the vaunted Death Watch to tell us what foe we face. A tyrannid vanguard organism will have been the root cause, yes? It has parasitized this world, spread its poison through the people, and turned them from the Emperor's light. This we had surmised.
You know the gene stealers for what they are. That much I can respect, said Red Fang,
and Lydran caught the flicker of grudging admiration in the Space Wolf's voice.
Yet, if you understand the peril, why haven't you silenced their call? Their call to what?
Asked Lydran, wrong-footed.
Their star children, spat Red Fang in disgust, singing out to the damned across the stars. Star children? What profane heresy is this? We had understood they worshipped something they call father, said Storn,
sounding personally affronted by such a cornucopia of heresies. Lydran was shaking his head slowly,
wishing to understand more.
Throne, you mean the Tyranids, don't you?
He said.
One of their...
A swift consultation of his memories.
Their splinter fleets.
Red Fang banged one fist upon the wood of the tabletop, hard enough to crack it.
This is why we have no time, he growled. They are coming, swarming like kraken on a blood tide. The cult, father, they're like a beacon to them, a signal fire leading them out of the darkness to feed.
You have seen them? You know this?
Asked Lydoran, his mind racing, reprioritizing strategic assets and reassessing everything about Captain Tor's plan for the pacification of Gaia. He felt his stomach plunge vertiginously at the thought that his steady and relentless methods might have damned this world rather than be saving it.
No, but every day the cult remains active increases the danger, said Sorkal. The Tyranids need not appear in the skies above for the enemy's work to be complete here. Just drawing them into proximity, into the fringes of the Segmentum Solar, is more than victory enough. These creatures cannot be reasoned with, cannot be discouraged or their morale broken. They are a plague, a swarm that devours everything before them until every last one of them is slain.
We know what Tyranids are, Wolf, said Lydoran flatly.
We know what their onset would mean, and we must uproot the entire cult to extinguish this... What? This signal fire?
Asked Ancient Tarson.
You realize how far the corruption spreads on this world, yes?
No, we don't have to kill them all, said Red Fang.
We have to hunt their patriarch to its lair and slay the beast. It is the source of beacon and cult both. We behead the beast, we behead the cult. But first, we have to find the damned thing. We have been trying, said Lydoran,
frustrated at the Fenrisian's apparent arrogance that he alone knew how to prosecute a hunt for such a Xenos beast.
We meet trickery and false trails at every turn. We need information. We get the thing's spore, we find its tracks, and we follow, said Red Fang. That's what my kill teams are about even now, disrupting your precious strategy. What my strike cruiser's augurs are seeking from within the sea of stars. What we are about to get out of these aristocratic whelps. You ready to help us now, then, Fist?
Lydoran scowled.
If what you say is true, then your mission and mine coincide. It is well that you intercepted Sergeant Torgon's message, that you followed it to its source, but I would still counsel caution, even if we do require speed.
The Governor is loyal. She and her conclave hold the strings to power on this world. With her cooperation, we can widen our search by a vast magnitude, speed both of our strategies towards their conclusion. If you alienate them, they will become your enemies and ours as well.
Alienate, said Red Fang,
one corner of his mouth quirking up to reveal a glinting fang.
We only have one method for dealing with aliens in the Death Watch.
So saying, he turned and threw open the double doors set into the room's far wall. Lydoran exchanged a look with Storn and Tarson, and the three of them followed Red Fang and Sorkal into the echoing courtroom beyond. The Court of Judgment was an ornately menacing chamber, with a high ceiling covered by a fresco of the Emperor and his Primarchs sitting enthroned, grim expressions upon their faces. A high pulpit stood at one end of the chamber, fashioned from wood and stone to resemble piled human skulls and leering gargoyles. More grotesques stared down from the galleries that lined the other three walls of the chamber, embossed with the crests of the great clans, Callistus chief amongst them. For most matters of law and order upon Gaia, trials took place within one of the many judiciary fortresses of the Adeptus Arbites. Justice in such places was swift, merciless and often final. Should a member of the Gairish elite, a spire lord or the master of a great clan, commit some act of perfidy and fail to get away with it, they instead found themselves in the Court of Judgment,
where their peers would consider their deeds and pass judgment upon them as only those with the rarefied perspective of fellow highborn could. There was a deliberate irony and a none too subtle message in the decision to incarcerate the Gyrish conclave here. Redfang might seem like a half-feral barbarian at first glance, but Lydran had a sense the watch captain was far cannier than he chose to appear. After all, while the librarian didn't know the intricacies of the Death Watch, he doubted very much that one remained with the alien hunters and received promotion to watch captain without being a quite exceptional individual. Still, as Lydran saw the governor and her chief advisers clustered upon the defendant's dais beneath the gun muzzles of half a dozen Death Watch battle brothers, he could not help but feel frustration at Red Fang's methods. The delegates looked dishevelled from rough manhandling, and their expressions ran the gamut through fear and panic to towering outrage. High Administrator Lunst was railing furiously at their treatment and brandishing a crumpled data parchment at her captors, the material of her torn sleeve wagging as she pointed the scroll accusatorily. High Marshal Callistus looked shell-shocked, as did Seneschal Grift. Clan Lords Van Sappen and Tektos veered between blandishments and threats, while First Arbitrator Verrill stood quiet and watchful, as though recording everything for later reference. Magos Gathabosis was blaring repetitiously that it made no logical sense for him to be incarcerated in such a fashion, quoting statistical damage to his optimized quotas and attempting to scuttle off the dais. He was encouraged back into place each time by the menacing barrels of bolt guns. Lydran saw no sign of Lord Delve or Bishop Renwick. At the centre of the gathering, managing to retain her regal presence and absolute composure despite her rough treatment, stood Governor Callistus. Despite her predicament, the Governor's eyes widened as she took in Lydran's battle-ravaged appearance. She inclined her head towards him, though whether the gesture was one of recognition or sympathy, or had some other, more obscure meaning, he didn't know.
"Ever I wish for the powers to see into others' minds," he thought.
"Silence!" roared Redfang,
and even without vox amplification, the sudden thunder of his voice was deafening as it echoed around the Court of Judgment. The delegates shut up at once, most of them turning several shades paler. High Administrator Lunst bristled, and Lydran could have sworn she was about to remonstrate with the hulking watch captain, but Governor Callistus spoke first. She looked straight at Lydran as she did so, as though to dismiss the presence of the Death Watch entirely.
"Brother Librarian, we were saddened to hear of your losses at Delphmine. We trust that your injury is not too grievous."
Remarkable, he thought. She might as well be still sitting upon her throne.
"Tch, he is a space marine, even if he's not Fenrisian. He is built for worse," growled Redfang. "Are you Governor?"
Callistus turned her regard upon Redfang, as though noticing him for the first time, and with no little disdain. The watch captain was feet away from her, a hulking presence that radiated barely contained violence like waves of heat. Lydran was genuinely surprised that she managed to mask the fear she must surely be feeling.
"You would threaten the person of an Imperial Planetary Governor, watch captain?" she asked him coldly. "You go too far, sir."
"If you are untainted, then you have no harm to fear from us. But understand me, Governor. I am of the Death Watch. That means whatever I do, whatever action I take, is justified. It will be borne out. So be silent and let me act, unless your intent is to delay me long enough for your Xenos allies to break you free."
Redfang bared his teeth.
"In which case, keep talking, and I will gun you down like an ice troll, court plundering an agridome."
Callistus gave him a haughty look, refusing to rise to his bait, but Lydran could sense her heart thumping painfully against her ribs, feel the swift and fearful pulse of blood through her temples. He was relieved that none of the other conclave members were fool enough to speak up, not even Jessamine Lunst.
"No one else? Thank the Allfather for small mercies," said Redfang. "You are here because some of your number are traitors.
either possessed by Xenos spirits or filled with their poison.
He drew a massive and much-notched chainsword from its scabbard at his hip.
You are here because our brothers in yellow have not seen fit to cut out the cankers yet.
Lydran scowled at this, resenting the Fenrisian's divisive derision, even as he felt the painful truth of it. Storn grunted with irritation and contempt beside him. Redfang revved the blade's serrated teeth, drawing frightened yelps from several of the assembled delegates.
Stormtooth and I are going to make that right. Now.
He turned and gestured with the blade. One of his battle brothers, a tall warrior with a mentor's shoulder guard, left the ring of sentries and crossed the room to where an ornately carved door of black iron was set into the wall. Over the doorway was a brass plaque that read, "Let no perfidy be hidden from the Emperor's sight." The mentor banged a fist against the door, and it swung open. Another battle brother, this one a golden-haired blood angel of prodigious size, hauled Lord Dostos Delve into the room as easily as a grown man might drag a small and truculent child.
"Unhand me! Unhand me!"
spat Lord Delve, whose rumpled robes and bruised face told a story of their own. The blood angel did so, lifting Delve slightly from the ground, then casting him forward so that the man overbalanced with a yelp and sprawled onto the defendant's dais. Before the clan lord could rise, Redfang was standing over him, Stormtooth's point hovering in front of Delve's face.
"Lord Dostos Delve, your clan extended the strangest welcome to our battle brothers when they landed there yesterday. What do you have to say about it?" asked Redfang.
Lord Delve looked up from the ground, raised himself slightly, and spat on Redfang's armored boot.
"You see how friendly you feel when those sent to liberate you turn up with all guns blazing," he said.
But Lydran could hear the anger and hopelessness in the man's voice. His words could not account for the mutants the Space Marines had faced, for the deliberate murder of the Adeptus Mechanicus overseers, or the explosive undermining of the Space Marines' advance, not to mention the worm forms daubed upon every available surface of Delve Mine. There was no defense for it that would wash, and Delve knew it. Red Fang's free hand gripped the heavy material of Lord Delve's hood. He tore it back to reveal a mop of thick curling hair. This he gripped in turn, taking a mighty fistful. He jerked it violently upwards. Lord Delve howled, not in pain, but in anger, as with an awful ripping sound, the prosthetic he wore was torn away. Revealed beneath was a dome-like scalp, hued a deep mauve, thick with pulsing veins and ridge-like plates. The crowd gasped and shrieked in revulsion. Delve hissed, the flesh of his face rippling and tearing as alien musculature moved beneath it. Needle fangs flashed in insectile jaws that yawned wide and tore the prosthetic mask where it adhered to his true face. Heavy shapes bulged beneath his robe, and cloth tore as clawed and chitinous limbs ripped their way into the light. Delve gave a woefully inhuman shriek and lunged with unbelievable speed, not towards Redfang, but straight at the dais. Straight, Lydran realized, for the governor. He reacted quicker than conscious thought, gathering his powers despite the warning flare from his psychocircuitry and throwing up a surging kinetic field between the governor and the thing that had been Lord Delve. Redfang moved just as fast, stepping with the Xenocultist lunge and bringing Stormtooth up in a howling arc that parted Dostos Delve's head from his shoulders. Blood jetted, thick and purple-black, splattering in gobbets across Lydran's shield before pattering to the ground like rain. Delve's body hit the floor, its insectile limbs drumming and flailing madly, as though still attempting to scramble towards Governor Callistus. Several of the Death Watch turned their guns upon the abomination as one. The crash of bolt fire rolled through the chamber like an avalanche. As the echoes faded, the ruptured remains of Lord Delve twitched their last and lay still amidst a spreading pool of gore. Panicked voices were raised amidst the conclave, and several of its members tried to back away from the foul remains. But Redfang turned his gaze upon them
and they all stilled again.
That worked amongst you, and not one of you saw it, he said,
and his voice was as cold and hard as the Fenrisian winter.
Whatever happens to this world, that fact will not be overlooked. Even those of you who are innocent of taint will have much penance to attend before you are judged worthy to rule again.
That was enough to quiet them, Lydaran saw. Even the governor's mask of composure cracked a little at the watch captain's words. He kept his own expression stony, yet the voices of self-doubt clamoured ever louder within. He had not seen. How could Storn and Tor ever have believed him fit for command?
Bring in the other one,
said Red Fang, flicking gore from the teeth of his blade. Again, a fist banged upon the black iron door. Again, a figure was brought through it, dwarfed by the space marine that hauled him along. Lottimer Renwick looked small and woefully powerless, yet his face retained a look of composure, and one hand held tightly to the Aquila pendant around his neck. Lydaran saw the man's eyes flick to the remains of Lord Delve and widen in horror. Though whether it was honest revulsion at so shocking a sight, or the terror of imminent discovery, he couldn't tell. The Blood Angel cast Bishop Renwick down next to the bolt-riddled remains, close enough that the small man splashed into a puddle of alien gore. Once again, Red Fang's blade swept out, its point hovering just below the bishop's chin, its engine idling.
Bishop Lottimer Renwick, you provided intelligence to Brother Librarian Lydaran that sent him and his brothers into Clan Dilth's trap, did you not?
Renwick looked up at Red Fang, his expression troubled.
My lord, I did not, he said,
and Lydaran heard nothing but honesty in the man's voice. Red Fang clearly heard it too, as his brows drew down and he tilted his head slightly as though in question.
You lie, Bishop,
Lydaran growled.
Bishop, there is clear vid capture of you having done this. Moreover, my brother attests you did so.
You seek to trick us, Red Fang said.
Renwick had the good sense to look frightened now, though he was keeping it under control as best he could. Cautiously, eyeing the tip of Red Fang's sword, he drew his knees up under him and straightened into a position of prayer.
If one of the Adeptus Astartes says this, then he must surely believe that is true. But I have no recollection of doing so.
Red Fang considered the priest for a moment. He glanced to Sorkal without lowering his blade.
Brother, what think you? Mind-slaving? Something parasitic? Or is he just a liar to make the trickster proud?
Sorkal paced across the chamber and stood over Renwick, frowning and tugging at one corner of his moustache.
One way to tell for sure, he said, and raised his Narthesium Vambrace.
This had been their intention all along, Lydaran realized. This little bit of theatre was for the governor's benefit, a display of the Death Watch showing restraint and knowledge as well as violence. Again, he had that sense of Red Fang's hidden cunning.
We possess Orspec's technologies that even our noble brothers within the Imperial Fists do not, explained Red Fang as Sorkal went to work,
panning his instruments over Renwick's slight form and frowning over the results that appeared on his device's display.
Their machine spirits are trained to detect Xenos biospore in ways no other chapter's sensors can. If there is taint here, we will know soon enough.
Lydaran watched Renwick's face as the apothecary completed his scan. The man looked pale and frightened, he thought, but also determined, as though ready to face whatever came next. Sorkar's Narthesium gave a low chime, and he blew out a breath.
Something parasitic, he said matter-of-factly. Something inside him. No doubt Delve's doing.
Parasitic,
croaked Renwick, his hands grabbing into fingers as they played over his face and body.
Where? What heresy is this?
We've seen it before. Psycho-reactive grubs that bore into their hosts and release bursts of neuro-emphatic directives before smothering the memories in a blanket of biochems, said Sorkal.
sounding almost regretful. Renwick looked horrified, and rightly so, thought Lyderin. That some Xenos thing could be inside his body, puppeting him on the cult's behalf, changing his memories at will. The thought was grotesque.
Take him away. Put him to question, Red Fang ordered, his tone merciless. His memories are buried, but they are not gone. Let us see what we can dig up.
Renwick was praying fervently, clutching his Aquila with both hands, tears creeping down his cheeks. But he didn't resist, as one of the Death Watch raised him to his feet and hauled him away.
Scan them all,
the Watch Captain ordered, gesturing to the Governor and her advisers and eliciting wails of fear.
With luck, there will be another grub or two between them. If so, we will discover where the prey makes its lair soon enough.
Chapter 10.
Lyderin and Storn walk slowly down an echoing cloister. For the first time since coming to Gaia, their battered armour was in the care of their chapter serfs, the two warriors instead clad in monastic robes. On one side, they passed a long tapestry that displayed in allegorical form the events of the Great Crusade and the fall of the traitor Horus, depicted as a demonic thing of shadow and ichor with curling horns and a serpent's tongue. On their other, they passed tall archways that led out onto a somewhat overgrown garden quadrangle, abandoned since the priests who once tended it had fled. Winged insects flitted from plant to plant, and to Lyderin's eyes the rare patch of true greenery looked incongruous amidst the sombre stonework. The cloister was part of a shrine to the imperial faith that had been evacuated and subsequently abandoned due to its close proximity to the Mercurio Gate spaceport. Some days earlier, apothecaries Laudus and Justin had claimed the structure as a meditatorium for those imperial fists wounded sorely enough to require convalescence before they could return to the fight. In the wake of the assault on Delvemine and the shocking events that followed, Lyderin had retreated here to think and to give his augmetic socket time to bed into his flesh. Now, as he and Storn walked, he flexed his fingers of his new bionic hand experimentally.
"How is it?"
asked Storn.
Strange, confessed Lyderin.
Storn remained silent for a few paces, as though inviting further comment on the librarian's new metallic forearm and hand. Instead, Lyderin said,
"You did not come here to ask me about my arm, Brother Chaplain."
"I did not," said Storn.
The two of them reached a long stone bench that looked out onto the sunlit garden. They sat. Lyderin's eyes roved, following the industrious insects gathering pollen from the plants. He flexed his metal fingers, hearing minute servos whine and joints click.
Uncomplicated,
Lyderin said, nodding to the insects.
They work, do their duty, live their simple lives and die. You do not see them troubled by sedition or heresy.
They are mindless and unworthy, replied Storn, his brows drawing down into a scowl. They, too, are not why I am here.
You are here because you wish to know why I linger when I should be out upon the front lines, driving our efforts to locate the brood nest that Red Fang seeks, said Lyderin.
In that moment, he felt unutterably weary, the sensation alien and unsettling to him. Storn looked sideways at him, his craggy features unreadable.
You are allowing your agmatic time to bed in, said Storn, his voice oddly stoic. Every brother in the Strike Force knows this. All beseech the Primarch for your swift return to battle.
Storn, I failed them, Lyderin replied,
and the words tasted bitter in his mouth.
I failed them. I failed you, and the Governor and her people.
He left one last name unsaid, biting it off before it could pass his lips. To his surprise, Storn's expression did not change.
You are allowing your augmetic time to bed in,
the chaplain repeated firmly.
Brother chaplain,
give me some credit, Aster, said Storn,
his voice now pitched low, his words swift.
I've been a chaplain for the Imperial Fists for more than a century, and a more stubborn, uncommunicative, and self-flagellating brotherhood I cannot imagine. You are an open tome compared to most of us, brother. It's one of the qualities that Captain Tor saw in you. So do not for a second think that you have to explain to me why you are sitting here wallowing in self-doubt. We cannot afford it. You cannot afford it. And neither can Gaia. No, you do not see the full extent of the corruption lurking in the Conclave. Neither did I, nor did Torgon before you, nor did any of his predecessors. Captain Redfang saw it because he already knew what to look for. We shall all do penance with the Pain Gauntlet when this campaign is done, and we will be sharper-eyed in the future for it. But for now, there's a war to be won, and the Strike Force needs its leader.
An urge came over Lydran then, to rail against Storn's words, to insist that he should have done better, fought harder, seen more. But he knew the chaplain was right. Instead, he drew a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Tell me this, Thysis. Why is that leader me? Why not you?
Storn let out a slow breath.
Because of what Tor and I saw in you since the day you joined us on the battle lines, Brother Librarian. Yes, your powers lend you an edge of perception and empiric capability vital to the prosecution of this conflict. But it is much more than that. You Primaris, I'd argue you're even further removed from humanity than the rest of us. Yet you, Lydran, you alone of all the Imperial Fists on this world retain a connection to our species, an empathy with them that keeps you grounded, balanced. You are better than you know, and that is a strength. Tor believed in you, so I believe in you. Sometimes, Brother Lydran, you have to take things on faith.
Lydran looked hard at Storn for a long moment, then snorted and turned back to the garden and its industrious insects.
You practiced that speech, he accused.
It is the duty of the chaplaincy always to have inspiring words to hand, replied Storn,
his voice carefully neutral.
I don't imagine our watch Captain Redfang would agree with your assessment, said Lydran,
his brows drawing down.
The Fenrisian seems to have little enough time for empathy or restraint. If there is one thing I know of Space Wolves, Aster, it is that they long to be with their own above all, said Storn. I've never had the honour of serving amidst the Death Watch, but I can only imagine that a tour of duty that takes them so far from their packmates, from that frozen ball of ice and hate they call a world, must be hard for the Space Wolves to endure. The saying is what? Homesick?
Asked Lydran, incredulous. Now it was Storn's turn to snort dismissively.
You sure those mutants wounded your arm and not your head, brother? I'm saying that for Redfang to have remained with the Death Watch long enough to become a captain, he must be exceptionally good at what he does, and for him to accept such a severing from the chapter he no doubt loves, he must be more selfless and honourable by far than his conduct implies, finished Lydran. And no doubt determined that if he's going to make such a personal sacrifice, then nothing is going to stand in the way of his making it worthwhile. And that, Strike Force leader, is what I came here to tell you.
Redfang has found the brute nest, said Lydran.
A mechanical whine sounded as his new hand clenched into a fist.
So he believes, said Storn.
As the two of them rose to their feet, Lydran set off at once, leaving his doubts behind to haunt the fringes of the overgrown garden. Storn followed.
How? A combination of kill team raids on Downhive cult hideouts, specialized bio-auguries from that thug of a ship he has lurking in orbit, and the excruciation of the former bishop and his fellow unfortunates.
Once, Lydran might have felt a stab of pity for Renwick, despite himself. The man might have been corrupted, irredeemably so, but it had not been by his own choice. Now, though, Lydrin felt little of anything towards the man, save disgust. Too much had been lost on his account.
Where? He asked, as they left the cloister.
The Fane of the Emperor Risen, one of Gaia's former architectural wonders, replied Storn. Right in the heart of the Commercius district of Claritos Hive.
I would still have expected one of the mine complexes, said Lydrin,
his siegecrafter's mind spinning over the possibilities, strengths and weaknesses of such a target.
As would I. And were we not now racing against time, I might still argue for further inspection, said Storn. But Red Fang is adamant. Cyoculum data, deep scan augury of the Fane's additional fortification, massed biospore, excess power drain from surrounding levels of Hive Claritos, they all point to the brood nest being there.
If that is so, then we need to strike swiftly, said Lydrin, his mind whirling through strategic variables. The cult has eyes and ears everywhere. If Red Fang has kicked the nest too hard, extracting this information, then it will not be long before Father knows we are coming.
The Watch Captain agrees, said Storn. He's ordered a full mobilization. Death Watch, our forces, the Gyrish. Of course, I rebuffed his initial suggestion that we ought to remain behind to guard our fortress.
Arrogant Fenrisian ass, snarled Lydrin, as they clattered down a flight of stone steps towards the arming chambers where their war gear awaited.
Once he might have dug in his heels and refused to allow Red Fang to command his forces in such a fashion. Now, after all that had transpired, it was almost a relief to allow another to dictate their course for a short time. Still, such notions only went so far. He would trust Lothar Red Fang to command this war alone, no matter how informed a position he might come from.
Indeed. But in truth, I do believe that a portion of our force ought to remain here, said Storn. Red Fang's orders will all but empty the hive. And while I'm all for striking with overwhelming strength, I believe that leaving the security of Angelicus and its governor in the hands of the Arbites and a few governatorial guardsmen risks disaster.
Agreed, Brother Chaplain, said Lydrin.
And I believe you should be the one to lead them. If Red Fang is right,
then I fear it may be a duty with scant honour in it, for the enemy will likely rally everything they have to defend their brood nest.
But if he is wrong, then who better to hold the line with all the belligerence and tenacity the Primarch would demand, eh?
Replied Storn. His smile was grim.
Sergeant Furion and his brothers have a few new augmetics between them, and they've lost a couple of brothers. Leave me them and the Hellblasters of Squad Ostor, and we will make damn sure the Governor and her people stay safe.
Lydrin halted outside the arming chamber and placed a hand on Storn's shoulder. Hammer blows and murmured prayers floated from the chamber's doorway.
Watch them carefully, Thysis, he said. Red Fang's cause might be true, but his methods were ill-advised, no matter how expedient. The Governor bore his insults as well as she might, but it won't be long before her counselors remember they have titles and reputations to protect. There is a storm of outrage likely to break when they do. One that our enemies could use as cover for their own efforts.
I have weathered far worse, Brother Librarian, said Storn. But thank you. Your counsel is wise. I will do what I can to impress upon them the importance of unity and vigilance in this pivotal hour.
Just keep them alive. They can bay for blood all they want once Father is dead, and we are done with this damned world, said Lydrin, with a grim smile that Storn returned.
Understood, Brother Librarian, said the chaplain,
and the two of them strode into the arming chamber, side by side. Several hours later, Lydrin was airborne, strapped once again into his restraint throne within the Thunderhawk, vengeful. The craft had taken a hammering, like much of the Imperial Fist strike force that had assaulted Delve Mine. However, just like the warriors it bore into battle, its hurts had been swiftly seen to, its war gear repaired and re-sanctified. The Sons of Dawn were ever indomitable, and the ambush to which they had been subjected had only cemented their determination to crush the heretics that endangered this world.
Lydrin checked the runic display in his helm's autosensors, then flicked his eyes through a series of external vidfeeds, confirming to himself that all was as it should be. His craft was one of five hulking yellow-armoured gunships that streaked north over the mist-shrouded jungles, bearing a combined force of warriors and war engines towards the distantly looming mountain of Hive Claritos. Lighter Imperial Fists aircraft flew around them, wings of storm talons and storm hawks holding position above, below, and to the flanks of the main strike force. The enemy had no air assets to speak of, as far as Lydrin was aware, but the cult of the writhing worm had surprised him more than once already. He was not about to let them fool him again.
"Managed to keep up this far? I am surprised, Fist," came Red Fang's brash voice over the command vox. "If all Death Watch are as ill-disciplined as you, then thank the Emperor that we have," Lydrin responded coldly.
Scrolling his field of vision, he took in the flight of Corvus Black Stars that swept over the mists off to his right. The Death Watch gunships were menacing beasts, he had to concede. They flew with their noses tilted slightly downward and their wings outswept, racing towards Hive Claritos like omens of death. Though more compact than the Thunderhawks by far, Lydrin didn't doubt that the Death Watch craft carried substantial arsenals of firepower. Deadlier still were the kill teams that waited within the troop bay of each ship, honed and hardened bands of the finest battle brothers from dozens of Space Marine chapters, trained and armed specifically to eradicate Xenos threats, no matter the cost.
"Was there a matter you wish to discuss, Watch Captain?" prompted Lydrin into the Space Wolf's continued silence. "Are you certain you Fists would not rather be dug in behind your nice big walls?" asked Red Fang, and Lydrin could hear the feral grin in the big Space Wolf's voice. "You forget, Watch Captain, that the Imperial Fists are as skilled in the breaking of fortresses as we are